listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. The views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Today's reading is from Ralph Waldo Emerson. Whatever you do, you need courage. Whatever course you decide upon, there is always someone to tell you that you are wrong. There are always difficulties arising that tempt you to believe your critics are right. To map out a course of action and follow it to an end requires some of the same courage that a soldier needs. Peace has its victories, but it takes brave men and women to win them.
This time of the year is a time of remembrance. Those who have served in the military or in daily life, everyone, may they be fondly remembered and blessed. And we are grateful for the way that people have enriched our lives, witnessing the courage of others, witnessing the brilliant self-expression of others, and grateful for the sacrifice that others have made on our behalf. As we commit to serving and continuing to put others above ourselves. Now I'll invite David forward to read to us a true story, a long story. It's a story worth hearing about Judith's 6 weeks in Gaza.
This story by Judith is as it was told earlier this month to an ABC journalist. I've worked in the emergency department of a large Australian hospital for 45 years, and I'm an emergency nurse through and through. I grew up by the beach in Sydney, and for as long as I can remember, I had wanted to be a nurse. I never even considered doing anything else. Since 2001, I've been volunteering overseas as a nurse. I would use my annual leave, or whatever leave I could, and sometimes I'd be gone for 6 months. I'd worked in Sudan, Myanmar, and Syria. I had planned to retire in 2020, but when COVID hit, I stayed and worked through the pandemic. When I did finally retire in 2022, I had planned to go to Afghanistan for 6 months. My dream job was working in an emergency department in Kandahar. About 4 days before I was to leave, the Taliban returned to power, and a difficult decision was made by the International Committee for the Red Cross that meant I was no longer able to go. I was devastated. I'm pretty sure I would still have gone despite the conflict and uncertainty. I always think of the need that exists in these countries, and I always feel that I have what it takes to go there, to give what I've got to the people in need. While I obviously consider my own safety, it's not my first priority when deciding where to go on mission. On Monday late last year, I received a call from the Australian Red Cross. What would you say about going to Gaza? I didn't hesitate. I flew to the Middle East the next Saturday. For 6 weeks, I worked at the European Gaza Hospital in Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza. I was among only the second rotation of international volunteer doctors and nurses and allied health workers to be posted to Gaza by the Red Cross since the war began in October 2023. The trip to Gaza began in Egypt. We travelled from Cairo through the Sinai to the Rafah border crossing and into Gaza. At the border, there was a queue of hundreds and hundreds of trucks lined up for miles waiting to cross into Rafah. They were full of water, food, medical supplies, and other aid, but could not get permission to cross into Gaza. In the other direction were cars and bikes loaded up with possessions as people were heading to the border, hoping to cross into Egypt. When we arrived at the hospital, we were shown to our room. We all slept in the nurses' education centre, sharing a space on the middle of the floor of the building, sleeping on thin mattresses on the floor, all lined up next to each other. On the day we arrived, we were in our scrubs and working in the hospital by lunchtime. The other nurses I was working with were highly skilled. One was from Rwanda, one from the UK, and one from Norway, who I had worked with in 2005 in Sudan. We all got on so well. The teamwork and friendships you develop while carrying out humanitarian work are unique. We all look after each other. The horror of the reality on the ground in Gaza hit quickly. We had no time to think. We just had to get into what was in front of us. The ward I worked in specialised in burns, simply because the first volunteer doctor who was placed at the European hospital in Gaza was a burn specialist and encouraged all the burn patients to be treated in our wards. The day started at about 8 a.m. and sometimes we didn't get back to the residence until about 9 or 9:30 at night. It took a toll. Everything changes every minute of the day, doing dressings, tending to more than 100 patients with broken sleep, our backs killing us. The burns were from explosions and fires caused by the bombs. It was horrendous. Other injuries we saw frequently were fractures caused by buildings collapsing on people who may have been trapped for days. Some had almost every bone in their body broken, and many were the only survivors of their family. Alongside the burns and the broken bones, those who survived the bombing had massive pressure injuries from being trapped for so long. Infection was just starting as I left. We did have a source of antibiotics, but it's hard to know how long it will last. We were running out of everything. We had to improvise what we used for dressings, and these improvisations were not as effective. And so we just worked with what we had. You just rack your brain and think, what's in the storeroom? What can I grab to use? Each room in the hospital had up to 18 patients. In a non-war period, each would have slept about 4. Alongside every patient were their families who took refuge in the wards as well, sleeping underneath the bed or along the corridor. At one point, the hospital ran out of water for several days. We could not flush the toilets. We were walking through excrement on the floor. It was a nightmare. Hundreds more Gazan families who had been made homeless had set up tents inside the hospital. Many more lived on the hospital grounds. There were 3 or 4 families living in one cubicle, separated by curtains. Most of these families had nowhere to go. Their homes had been destroyed. Being inside the hospital brought a sense of security, believing that, because the hospital was staffed with some people from the Red Cross, it would be safe. Every day, a member of each family would venture out to find food. There were markets that had locally grown eggplant and tomato. Potatoes would come and go, because the farmers found it too risky to harvest those potatoes. Fishermen were also too afraid to go out in their boats in case they were a target. Eggs would come and go from the market too. We did see mandarins when I first arrived, but after that we never saw any fruit. Regardless of any available food, we didn't like to visit the market because this was the only food source for Gazans. Most of the foreign volunteer nurses brought home food from home, and we had drinking water because we brought it with us. We were lucky, and for that reason I never ate or drank in front of those I worked with. The hospital supplied the local nurses with small amounts of food from World Central Kitchen. Many of these nurses arrived from northern Gaza to work with the understanding they would receive a meal a day and free lodging with no running water. They came with dozens of members of their family, so that meal was shared with many people, and most lived in tents and worked 24-hour shifts. I think throughout my whole 24 years of doing missions, I've learned how to survive. I took dried fruit, nuts, noodles and dehydrated foods. We all shared what we had and we didn't go hungry. We did have a lot of tuna. I don't know how the local Palestinian staff kept going. During my time in Gaza, more and more people were being pushed down from the north, and the intensity of the bombing picked up. The bombs were coming closer and closer, being dropped basically just across the road from the hospital. There was a lot of fear, even though international humanitarian law, hospitals are protected against attack, many people still found it difficult to feel safe. A lot of local staff were leaving. Even a lot of the internally displaced people living in tents in the hospital left. One of the medical staff I worked with had six boys, gorgeous, gorgeous kids. He just said, "This is all too much, I'm leaving." He left for Rafah, feeling at the time it was safer than the hospital. And that's when all the nurses also started to wonder if we were really safe. The deaths of the World Central Kitchen aid workers was a frightening reminder of the dangers faced by aid workers in Gaza right now. The food at the hospital where I worked was supplied by the World Central Kitchen. The killing of these volunteers after being given the green light to work in Gaza will have a ripple effect that will affect so many in need. Every week, the hospital director would learn of his family members living elsewhere in Gaza who were killed. First his brother was killed, then one by one, all of his family. Another day, the doctors told us that five of their doctor friends who lived together in one house had all been killed. They could not stop to mourn. They just kept working. They worked around the clock. I had never really heard bombs before. There was bombing 24 hours a day, and it steadily became worse. We couldn't sleep because the missiles, bombs, and gunfire were hitting close by. We slowly got used to it. We had no choice. Every time a bomb landed near us, the door in our room would blow open and the window shook. You could not say we felt safe. We just didn't allow ourselves to think about it. You've got bombs going off, and some of them were getting so close the building was shaking. There wasn't enough food or water. The tension was so high. Things could become volatile very quickly because of the stress the patients and their families were under. There were many arguments and people were screaming at each other. The pressure and fear was always there. On Christmas Day, we had two deaths in the morning. That was the most horrendous day because the bombs became more intense as well. We used an operating theatre as a safe room. If there were three bombs close together, we would go to this operating theatre on the ground floor with very solid walls and running water inside. The bombs just got closer and closer, more and more intense during the last 2 weeks of my mission. I don't see it as brave. I do sometimes wonder why I have no fear, but I just feel that this is what I was born to do.
As we contemplate Judith's story, our musicians will play for us a Neil Young song, Love and War.
I sing about love and I don't really know.
In the course of preparing some reflections today, I read through the seven Unitarian principles. Reading them out is probably something I don't do often enough. But the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large, the goal of world community with peace, liberty and justice for all, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Now, really, I don't know how anyone could disagree with those principles. It occurred to me, however, that they allow a certain kind of passivity. We can look at them and say, yes, we agree. We would like peace and justice, sure. But it's not actually asking us to do anything. Are we called upon just to be bystanders of life and agree with all these fine principles? What are we meant to do to honour these principles? The fact is, we're called upon every day to serve others in some way. It's very obvious for a parent or someone with an intimate partner with whom they reside. But there are helpful things we can do to people we don't even know. Encouraging words can be offered. Meals can be prepared and shared. We can offer to help in any number of ways. To take that step sometimes requires courage and sacrifice, putting ourselves out for the sake of another. The American writer Daniel Foster Wallace wrote that the most precious kind of freedom, quote, involves attention and awareness and discipline and effort and being able to truly care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in myriad petty little unsexy ways every day. Next Thursday is Anzac Day, commemorating the landing of young English, New Zealander and Australian men on the Gallipoli Peninsula on the 25th of April 1915. For nearly 30 years, I've been attending dawn services. I've been asked to speak at quite a few of them, and I've always said yes. I've always seen it as an opportunity to deliver a message of peace and to underline the horror of war. It generally seems to be well received, even with army veterans who have actually experienced some of those horrors. Anzac Day also invites contemplation of mateship. And there's more to see here than the facile teasing and emotionally stunted chatter about cars and footy. Veterans have bonded together in comradeship in the same way experienced by any group who have helped each other survive intense experiences and traumatic episodes. This bond, which the uninitiated cannot ever hope to really understand, creates a permanent, unspoken bond of mutual respect. Some of the veterans have memories of extraordinary acts of bravery, running into a field of fire to carry out an attack, leading mates through enemy lines to get back safely, diving into the sea to rescue others. And many have seen their mates killed in battle, or in all manner of premature deaths brought on by stress, unresolved trauma, and hard living. In military language, death on the field is euphemistically referred to as the supreme sacrifice. Death anywhere can be seen as the supreme loss from an ego point of view. But I say it is euphemistic in that it frames the death as the cost of winning a noble cause, when most wars are fought for nothing of the sort. Most wars, of course, are fought to gain or protect resources. Certainly wars of colonisation fit that description. At least those who resist colonisation can genuinely claim a noble cause, the freedom and independence of their people. The nations of might, without such justification, have to sew on all sorts of fig leaves to cover their naked butchery and plunder. In Australia, we often hear that our soldiers went to risk their lives to defend our liberties, which is rather tiresome in the World War I context, which was about protecting the commercial interests of the British Empire and other empires. Shouldn't it be a universal requirement that politicians taking the nation to war should be the first ones to send their children to the front line? Oh, I'm forgetting the golden rule. The ones with the gold makes the rules. So you see how easily I can get into trouble with my Anzac Day speeches at the RSL. It requires a delicate choice of words to genuinely give thanks for the sacrifice and bravery of those who served the nation without indulging in the deception of nationalism, even when many of those present accept the government line of why they went to war. It's not easy. I have travelled to Anzac Cove, and we should never underestimate the extraordinary challenge faced by those men who were ordered one cold, dark morning to land on little beaches and then to climb steep, craggy cliffs with backpacks and rifles. They were being shot at before they even got to the beach. I'm sure many of them had no bloody idea what they were getting into. Yes, they should be honoured. Let's also honour those women who served in the Gallipoli campaign. Generally speaking, not going ashore, but serving as nurses on the hospital ships offshore. And some of those traumatised for many years by the wounds they saw and those who died in their arms. But I wonder whether the commemorative gatherings of veterans in Australia and around the world have led in a way to men taking over the concept of courage. Many people, the first, if you ask, what do you think of courage? People think of soldiers on the battlefield. But as author L. Frank Baum has The Wizard of Oz say to the lion in the original Wonderful Wizard of Oz story, which was published in 1900, "You have plenty of courage, I'm sure," answered Oz. "All you need is confidence in yourself. There is no living thing that is not afraid when it faces danger. The true courage is in facing danger when you are afraid, and that kind of courage you have in plenty." In a similar vein, the hero Atticus Finch says to his daughter Jem in Harper Lee's novel To Kill a Mockingbird, "I wanted you to see what real courage is, instead of getting the idea that courage is a man with a gun in his hand. It's when you know you're licked before you begin, but you begin anyway, and you see it through no matter what. You rarely win, but sometimes you do." Courage, then, is far more than bravery displayed on the battlefield. It means being who you are. It means expressing yourself to the limit of your rights and standing proudly and loving yourself as you are. It is lending your voice to those less able to speak for themselves, no matter how unpopular the cause. It is speaking up on the bus when you see a person who was the victim of racial teasing. Enough of me for the moment. Let us stand and sing the short hymn, Rise Up, O Flame. The sheets have been handed around and we'll get straight into it. Please stand if you're able. I have a few more thoughts to offer. We take the word courage from the French courage, which in turn stems from cor, the Latin for heart. To be courageous, then, is to be big-hearted, to express the love and sense of justice in your heart. You can say bon courage to someone in a race or on a sports field, or someone about to undergo a job interview or surgery. Have a good heart. Bon courage. It's so much more meaningful than good luck. Best of British. Fingers crossed. Or break a leg. Let's take a couple of examples. And for a start, think back to the story we heard of Judith's 6 weeks in Gaza. Volunteering to go into a war zone to literally save the lives of others where there are no red lines, no international humanitarian law respected. Like Zomi Frankom as well, the aid worker for Central World Kitchen, blown up in a convoy of 3 vehicles, each of which was separately targeted and destroyed as it travelled at a time and along a road agreed in advance with the occupying army. That was truly a supreme sacrifice. For another example, from my memories, let me take you back to 1980s South Africa. There were, of course, millions opposing the apartheid regime, but only a courageous minority among the non-Indigenous population. I was privileged to have known a Jewish mama dedicated to the anti-apartheid cause in the 80s. She raised funds for the ANC and regularly drove to the shanty camps outside Cape Town, where many hundreds of thousands lived in shelters made from scraps of galvanised iron, with little income and little hope. Driving alone through such places, inhabited by many desperate people, was an act of courage in itself, as many would not have known she was there to help them. But she also had to resist the attentions of the security forces. Late one night, they raided her comfortable Cape Town residence, and despite her height-challenged and weighty physicality, she flew over the back fence like a gazelle. So I'm told. In a vastly more genteel context, the same spirit is epitomised by Elizabeth Bennet in Jane Eyre's Pride and Prejudice, when she says to the imposing Mr. Darcy, "There is a stubbornness about me that can never bear to be frightened at the will of others. My courage always rises at every attempt to intimidate me." C.S. Lewis wrote The Screwtape Letters. It consists of a series of letters in which a senior demon instructs a junior demon on how to bring a human being to moral ruin. I don't need to tell you it's a work of fiction. But one may surmise that many of the devilish propositions represented the beliefs of the author. In letter 29 of the book, it is asserted that, quote, "Courage is not simply one of the virtues, but the form of every virtue at the testing point, which means at the point of highest reality." Whether or not you agree with the Christian orientation of C.S. Lewis's work, there is much wisdom in it. And I can't resist paraphrasing another quote. "God wants men and women to be concerned with what they do. The devil's business is to keep them thinking about what will happen to them." Whenever you find yourself thinking, well, what will happen to me if I speak up? What will they say about me if I really express who I am? Perhaps you can turn it around. Turn it around, thinking instead of what you can do to express yourself, what you can do to help others, what you can do to encourage others with a kind word in a particular situation. We can be grateful that here in beautiful Adelaide, we generally live without fear for our physical safety if we speak up for our rights or speak up for a just cause. There's no shortage of egos willing to judge us, however, to criticise us and condemn us. Stating the obvious, they are not acting out of love. It's because they fear their own inadequacy. Their ego must attempt proof of superiority. And the easiest way to do that is to put other people down. Unable to connect to their own inner source of love and peace, they seek to cut you off from yours. Please never accept when people try to do that. Just seeing it for what it is takes the force out of it. Retaining your dignity and self-respect, staying your course, if it is an expression of who you truly are, this may take courage. You have that courage available to you. Relish the truth of this pithy poetry from Adam Lindsay Gordon, the 19th century Australian poet. He wrote in 1866, "Life is mostly froth and bubble. Two things stand like stone, kindness in another's trouble, courage in one's own." So I charge you to speak the truth of yourself, to express yourself, no matter what others think of you, to commit random acts of kindness, no matter what. Press on through your challenges with courage. You have that courage in you. Bon courage. Bon courage, people!
We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitarianSA.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians or by visiting our website at unitarianSA.org.au. Yeah.